The Guardian.
The joy of ebooks is that great stories are just a click away. For our podcast listeners, we have a great offer on Luke Harding's book Mafia State, a menacing tale of life as a journalist in present-day Russia. I'll tell you more at the end of the show.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Classic poetry aloud.
Okay, why do I think poetry is a great thing? Well, all people love it when we're small. The rhythms of it.
This reading by Gordon Mackenzie, Leaves of Grass, by Walt Whitman.
Dites-moi dans quel pays effleura la belle romaine, la chipie à qui fut sa cousine germaine.
I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb, when one who died for truth was lain in an adjoining room.
Oh, young Lochinvar has come out of the west, but through all the wide border his steed was the best, and save his good broadsword he weapons had none, he rode all unarmed and he rode all alone. So faithful in love and so dauntless.
What I'm really grateful about this is that, one, I've actually had to sit down and read them, which I love the process of just reading aloud poems. It just makes you feel better. You know, it's just a bit of a therapy. Isn't it sweet?
This week is all about stars. We've got stars of the acting world. You probably recognised Helena Bonham Carter up there. Stars of the music firmament and, not least, stars of the poetry world. This is the week when Jorry Graham became the first American woman to win the Forward Poetry Prize. This is the week when we celebrate English poems. This is the week when a popular app for your tablet computer turns into a book rather than the other way round. So let's start with that. It's called IF, or lowercase I, uppercase F, looking rather like a tree on the cover of the book. And it's a treasury of poems for almost every possibility. And they've got some extremely starry readers for the app version.
Bright Star by John Keats. Bright star, would I were steadfast as thou art, not in lone splendour hung aloft the night and watching, with eternal lids apart, like nature's patient, sleepless eremite. The moving waters at their priest-like task of pure ablution round earth's human shores, or gazing on the new soft fallen mask of snow upon the mountains and the moors.
The Owl and the Pussycat by Edward Lear. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money, wrapped up in a £5 note. The owl looked up to the stars above and sang to a small guitar. Oh, lovely pussy, oh, pussy, my love. What a beautiful pussy you are, you are, you are. What a beautiful pussy you are.
They've also got A Starry Design, All Twinkly Yellow by Natasha Law, who just happens to be the sister of a star, Jude Law. With me in the studio to discuss it are Ali Asiri and Rachel Kelly, editors of the anthology, who cooked up the original app on their kitchen table. Can that be true, Ali?
Yes, I always loved poetry, especially when I was a child. Rachel and I worked on it from her kitchen table and my kitchen table. And it was really good fun. And as we developed it, we realised really good actors would be the way to go and beautiful illustrations would help.
The world of an app is an incredibly good fit with poetry because you are then in touch with people around the world who love poetry, and we've become part of this wider poetic community. So we sold tens of thousands of apps, and we get feedback continuously, which we have invited and which we absolutely welcome.
This is a good point, actually, because we've been getting a bit of flack recently for being a bit parochial on this podcast. So if you are one of the people who complain, please take note. This app sells in how many countries?
I think the latest is at 39 countries.
Here you have this app, and then along comes Canongate, a very hip publisher. Says, can we make a book of it? Is that how it happened?
We have a great friend called Tiff Lerners who was working at Canongate at the time. And in fact, she called us in a couple of weeks before the app even launched. And she just thought it was going to do well. I'm not really quite sure how she had that much trust in us.
This presumably is one of their big Christmas offerings. And their last Christmas offering was Noel Fielding. So it's they're taking a turn down the age range, although you rather cheekily suggest that it's suitable for children aged from 0 to 90. Well, defend yourselves.
Well, I think as far as we understand, poetry wasn't specifically written for children. Poetry was written and then people of different ages could enjoy it and interpret it in different ways. And I think we feel that very strongly. I think both of us loved poetry as a child, but some of the poems we read as children, now in our older age, we can read in a different way and we can take something different from them. And I think that has been our experience and that's been the feedback we've got, is that actually we did start, you know, thinking about children, but in fact, what we found is that people of all ages respond to the poems on our app. People of all ages respond to the poems in the book.
You've themed it, so it's growing up, humour and nonsense, friendship and love, for instance. Some of them are very familiar, but there are also some more challenging poems. Is either of you going to be brave enough to read an old English riddle by our old friend Anon?
This is a bit of a challenge. I think I'll try for the last line. They, he, them, wordum, swelk.
So you'd have to be about 40 to understand that? A bit younger than me, perhaps a bit older than you, but certainly not 90 and certainly not naught. And what does it mean?
It means he swallowed the words.
And it's actually a really lovely poem, isn't it? You have the little translation underneath about moths swallowing words.
It's an old English riddle. It's over 1,000 years old. That is definitely the oldest poem in our book.
In the book, we've done little introductory paragraphs where we felt it gave you something extra when you were reading the poem. And that was all part of making poetry accessible. And so on the old English riddle, there's a nice explanation of what's going on. Because as you say, it's not completely obvious. We also have a guide to different poetic terms at the back of the book. And we also have a special section, which we call our sticking plaster section, in which we direct you to different poems for different needs, which was a big part of our app as well.
If you need help, if you're facing grief.
Do you have a lot of international writers? Or is it very UK-based?
Americans, Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman. There's an Apollinaire picture poem, which is a picture poem of the Eiffel Tower. Which I hope people will think is fun to discover. When they've maybe got tired of words, we thought it would be quite fun to come across a pattern poem.
We've got quite a lot of modern voices as well. So yes, you're absolutely right. We did start from a sort of brief of the kind of absolute classics, but we've got Carol Ann Duffy, we've got John Agard. We got a very nice Christopher Logue one. For the man in search of rural seclusion, if all else fails, try Wales.
Carol Ann Duffy's The Hat is quite different to the poetry that she's familiar for me with. It's sort of fan poetry, isn't it? It's a history of poetry in a poem.
Yeah, I thought it just fit very well with the anthology, because in her poem she takes you through from the beginning of poetry right through to the end. So I thought it was sort of rather delicious discovery that if you were finding yourself really enjoying getting to know all these poets, that she encapsulates in her poem.
Actually, I tried it with my children, which is that she references so many of the classics which are in the book that you can actually play a game, which is, where is this line, which poem, where does it come from? As she references really an awful lot of the poems we've got.
I do think it's a book to share with the family. And another thing that happened with the app is that we realised when children are on their computers or on their iPods, if they're lucky enough to have one, parents can feel quite alien and not included in what they're doing. And that our app is an app, and hopefully the book too, is something that you share with the family.
Well, I hope that you have done your product testing properly on your children and you don't get the reception that Awesome Charlie, one of our children's site members, gave to Jacqueline Wilson's Green Glass Beads back in the summer. Awesome Charlie wrote, "Green Glass Beads is probably a lovely book of poems for poem lovers, but unfortunately I'm not a poem lover and I'm not keen on poems. Even though I struggled to the end, I don't like this book." But listen to this, Awesome Charlie.
Hope is the Thing with Feathers by Emily Dickinson. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chilliest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me.
To His Coy Mistress by Andrew Marvell. Had we but world enough and time, this coyness, lady, were no crime. We would sit down and think which way to walk and pass our long love's day. Thou, by the Indian Ganges' side, shouldst rubies find. I, by the tide of Humber, would complain. I would love you 10 years before the flood, and you should, if you please, refuse till the conversion of the Jews. My vegetable love should grow vaster than empires and more slow. 100 years should go to praise thine eyes and on thy forehead gaze, 200 to adore each breast, but 30,000 to the rest, an age at least to every part, and the last age should show your heart. For, lady, you deserve this state, nor would I love at lower rate.
And now to our new Forward Prize winner, Jory Graham. Place is the 12th collection for Graham, who, though little known in this country, has been described as perhaps the most celebrated poet of the American post-war generation. She talked to Nick Rowe.
This is the poem Sundown. It takes place on Omaha Beach on June 5th. In the present day, sometimes the daylight winces behind you, and it is a great treasure. In this case today, a man on a horse in calm, full gallop on Omaha over my left shoulder, coming on fast but calm, not audible to me at all until I turned back my head for no reason, as if what lies behind one had whispered, "What can I do for you today?" And I had just turned to answer, and the answer to my answer flooded from the front with the late sun he, they were driving into, gleaming. Wet chest and upraised knees and light struck hooves and thrust out even breathing of the great beast from just behind me, passing me, the rider looking straight ahead and yet smiling without looking at me as I smiled, as we both smiled for the young animal, my feet in the breaking wave edge, his hooves returning as they begin to pass by to the edge of the furling break, each tossed-up flake of ocean offered into the reddish luminosity, sparks as they made their way, boring through to clear out life, a place where no one again is suddenly killed, regardless of the cause. No one, just this galloping forward with force through the low waves, seagulls scattering all round, their screeching and mewing rising like more bits of red foam, the horse's hooves now suddenly louder as it goes by and its prints on wet sand deep and immediately filled by thousands of sand fleas thrilled to the declivities in succession in the newly released beach, just at the right moment for some microscopic life to rise up through these cups in the hard upslant retreating ocean is revealing. Sand fleas finding them just as light does, carving them out with shadow and glow on each ridge and water oozing up through the innermost cut of the hoof steps. And when I shut my eyes now, I am not like a blind person walking towards the lowering sun, the water loud at my right, but like a seeing person with her eyes shut, putting her feet down one at a time on the earth.
Forward judges, who are apparently unanimous in their decision, praised your book as a collection of unusual force and originality, forging connections between inner experience and a world in crisis. I mean, the themes could hardly be bigger. Could you say a little about its genesis and what you were hoping to achieve with these poems?
The issue of how inner and outer experience in each of us at any given moment in life interlace is very much at the core of my search in this book, and probably in prior books as well. Mm-hmm. But in structuring the book, I noticed how many of the poems took place with one's eyes closed or in the process of closing or opening. And I found myself wondering, what does it mean to still move forward in one's life as one ages, or on the planet as it faces potentially looming catastrophe, with one's eyes not trained on a horizon line, but rather, if you can imagine it, closed in order to take in the vast susurration of knowledge supplied by what we call peripheral vision. Peripheral vision is a more ancient part of the instrument, and it involves intuition, and it was used in our early days as humans in hunter-gathering in evening light, dusk hunting. So we tend to be culturally and personally encouraged to live increasingly in the present moment, constantly eyeing the future, but to my mind, not peering into it anywhere deeply enough. One of the things about the way I try in my poems to dilate the present moment in which we live is that it permits you to achieve a kind of presence, wholeness, even a sense of what you'd call integrity, which turns into accountability. There's so many scientists asking artists to help them make the sensation of what deep futurity is feel real to a listener or a reader. They have a hard time getting people to understand that the actions that we undertake today need to be undertaken on behalf of someone who is living 20 generations hence. For me, one of the most powerful instruments that we have as humans to do this is the imagination.
Now, you've chosen to present these ideas and these poems in a very sort of specific physical and visual way. The book is square rather than oblong. The title of the book, Place, is in capital letters, were sort of spaced out a little bit, almost as if they're individual letters rather than a full word.
I don't think of the poems as visual presentations. They are written in accentual verse, in extremely long lines and extremely short lines, and they've been kind enough on both sides of the Atlantic to make books that accommodate the longer line, therefore the square book. And the form is meant to feel vertiginous as one traverses it. One is meant to feel the momentum behind one as one slows in the eddies of the short lines, and then the suction of what is before one as yet untraversed as one redilates into the long lines. And the poems do explore momentum and how we inhabit it. Robert Frost has a wonderful line when he says a poem has to move at achieve a certain airspeed in order to carry freight. My poems have always explored the sensation of experience as it courses through one, and how at the tensile edge between objective and subjective experience, the feeling of being comes alive. So the form is in service of that.
Now, you're the first American to win the Ford Prize, although maybe we'll quibble over whether Tom Gunn is American or not. It seems that in the world of fiction, so British and American novelists travel between the continents pretty easily, and roughly the same people are reviewed in, say, the New York Times and the Guardian. But it doesn't seem quite true of poetry. Is the old cliche of two countries separated by a common language a bigger problem in poetry than it is in prose?
Not in my experience. American and British poets read each other, and I think the relationship is really quite intimate between the two poetries. They are different poetries. They don't require translation, but they do involve a different kind of reading. But the declining readership for poetry is more dramatic in the U.S. than in the U.K. because of the really drastic collapse of our educational system and our publishing industry. And I don't think that you guys can imagine just how disastrous our schools are. When I look at the children of friends who are going to school anywhere in the U.K. or in France or in Germany or in Italy, the fact that they still read literature and poetry and study it, and it's something that's part of the curriculum, is something which is pretty much gone from American education except in private schools. So, you know, at a certain point, that does affect the reading of the whole medium. I do think of poetry as a kind of canary in the mine. Very few cultures in the history of humanity have survived if their poetry disappears. So with a poetry culture as vivid and alive as it is in the UK, I think the canary is doing okay in your mind, and I think our canary is running out of breath, is croaking a little here.
Super Thursday falls next week. It's the day in the publishing world when all the titles vying for that lucrative Christmas slot will be published in a big bang. There are an awful lot of musicians this year, including Pete Townsend of The Who. So we sneak to listen to him reading.
The Who were to play on day two of the festival, the last show, Saturday night, following Sly and the Family Stone and Janis Joplin. The scene greeting us at the backstage area of the festival was horrific. The entire parking area was a slurry of thick, gelatinous mud. The backstage crew were covered in it, and their travels back and forth to the stage were traipsing mud everywhere. As I got out of the car, I slipped and sank up to my knees. There were no dressing rooms available, so we went to a tent with a hot water machine, tea bags, instant coffee, and a coffee dispenser. I helped myself and within minutes realized the water had been spiked with acid. It was fairly dilute, but as the low-level trip kicked in about 20 minutes later, I noticed a photo of Meher Baba posted high on a telegraph pole. It was a wonderful moment. The image was ubiquitous at the time. Meher Baba as a young man, handsome, long-haired, Christ-like. It felt like a sign to me that everything would be okay. Then tragedy struck. As I gazed at the photo, a young man, barefoot and shirtless, clearly out of his head, leapt up on the roof of an ambulance parked under a telegraph pole and gracefully shinned up some 30 feet. As he touched the photo, he screamed and fell backwards, landing on top of the ambulance. The telegraph pole was, in fact, a power line. The paramedics ran out to attend to the unconscious man. When I went into the first aid tent to investigate, I thought I'd just walked onto the set of MASH. There were cots of patients everywhere, mainly young people on bad trips, but some injured, mostly kids suffering from bouts of terror. Back outside the tent, I saw the faces of John and Keith peeping out from the back window of a station wagon. They waved and grinned. Later, I learned that each of them had a girl's mouth around their cocks. I walked alone along the edge of the main field where most of the audience gathered. Rumour had it that over 1 million people had come to Woodstock, and it looked like half that number were scattered on the hill. The light was fading fast as I entered an eerie woodland scene. Naked fairies danced between the trees. Dealers carrying trays of ready-made joints, tabs of acid, hash, grass and rolling papers. As I broke through the woods, I came across the open area where most of the campers were strewn about. Thousands sat listening to the music pulsating up the hill from the stage, as though in a natural amphitheatre.
With me in the studio now is Casper Llewellyn-Smith from our music desk, who has bravely volunteered to run us through all the singers and stutterers in a Christmas celebrity market that actually, as I said before, does appear to be dominated by old rockers. Is that true, Casper?
That seems right. Thanks very much for having me. I've smartened myself up for the Books podcast and pulled myself out of bed because I've spent the last couple of weeks immersing myself in a lot of these books. I think Pete probably has written his own. I mean, Townsend, of course, has got a literary pedigree. He was an editor at Faber for a while in the early 80s and is, you know, erudite and a fascinating guy, actually. I mean, I think the book is really terrific and much more interesting. I'm not saying that The Who are a greater band than, say, The Stones or The Beatles, but I think all along I was expecting more from Pete Townsend's autobiography than I would from a Jagger autobiography or even a Paul McCartney one.
There's quite a lot of confessional about his early life in it, isn't there?
It's all deeply confessional. I mean, it's really raw stuff. And, you know, he really has lived a life. I mean, what's impressive, I guess, in a way, is that after a couple of hundred pages, you've reached sort of Woodstock and The Who making records like Tommy and Quadrophenia. And there's still another 400 pages to go. It isn't just about the 60s and that kind of burst of glory. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, something which has overshadowed his career in recent years are the allegations with the child pornography and all that business. And he goes into that in extensive detail as well.
We had a very nice preview of these in The Observer, in which the phrase chemical recreation was used. Is there a lot of chemical recreation in Pete Townsend's?
Part of the thing about Townsend that's so interesting was that when The Who started out, he was not really that into being hugely promiscuous, kept trying to be faithful to his girlfriend, tried not to really be a rock star. You know, he came from an art school background and had a very clear idea of what this new thing, and it was new then, could be, this powerful new music, and thought of it as an art form. And then what you get in the book is a slide in the early 70s into just ridiculous sort of rock star debauchery and the philandering and the drugs and very vivid passages where suddenly he's in New York, I think, in perhaps the early 80s and has developed a bit of a liking for crack cocaine and says, I was there in some dive bar with a bunch of businessmen suits and a pal of his, and they're walking out of the bar as the dawn's coming up, and one of the businessmen comes up to him and says, that incredible looking girl that you're friends with, I've got to tell you, it's not really a woman. Pete says, you know, we have been smoking crack cocaine and issues like gender weren't that important at the time. You know, it's all that kind of rich rock and roll lore.
And so how about the others? I mentioned that there are loads of them. We've got Bob Dylan, Neil Young, Rod Stewart.
Bob Dylan's Chronicles, which came out 5 years or so ago, I mean, that sort of set the template for a lot of these books and I think did well in the market and encouraged other rockers of the same generation to think that they should have a go at doing the same. So Neil Young has now written his memoir, which has got a fantastic title called Waging Heavy Peace. He clearly has written this book himself as well, and that's both a very good thing and also a very bad thing. It's very much like a Neil Young record. Neil Young famously was sued by his own record company in the mid-1970s for making music that was uncharacteristic of Neil Young. Because he decided to go off in his own way and make a record that didn't sound like that kind of folky thing that sold in its millions and people loved. Here's a passage from the book. It's not read, unfortunately, by Neil Young himself. It's the actor Keith Carradine. But the action picks up, I think, when Neil has gone to San Francisco really for the first time in the late 60s and meets people like Paul Kantner from the Jefferson Airplane. And he's working with Crosby, Stills and Nash in the supergroup Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And they record the classic song Ohio, which is a response to the shooting at Kent State University of I think, four students.
One day I visited Butano Canyon near Pescadero, California with Crosby. It was 1970, and our CSNY lighting director, Steve Cohen, was living in a place right at the end of Butano Canyon Road. Since it was the last house, there was nothing but canyon to see from the deck of the old Redwood home. Most of the houses in this canyon had been constructed as summer residences, and were old places built totally with redwood, featuring heat from great stone fireplaces made with stones right from the creek. It was a stunning place. Giant redwoods and the healthy creek running by made for a spectacular view. Crosby had invited me up there to see the place and hang. Leo Makota, our road manager, was there too. It was Leo, as I mentioned, who first directed me to what is now Broken Arrow Ranch. Cross really wanted to see me living up north. He loved it up there himself. Cross had also taken me to the airplane house where Jefferson Airplane lived. There I met Grace Slick, who was beautiful, sang great, was topless, and blew my mind. That was the first time I met her. The whole San Francisco scene was something I had never seen. It was overwhelming. I remember Paul Kantner driving Cross and me to the airport from the city in his Porsche, demonstrating that the airport was only 20 minutes from Haight-Ashbury now that Interstate 280 had been opened. I was scared shitless with Kantner driving that Porsche at astronomical speeds to demonstrate how easy it was to get there fast. I was really not used to any of this stuff. I was shaking when we got to the airport to get on PSA for $9.95 and be served by stewardesses in short shorts on our way back to L.A. Holy shit. Was I green? So anyway, we're in Butano Canyon at Stephen Leo's place, and the tragedy at Kent State had just happened. Time magazine had a picture of the girl, Allison Krauss, after the National Guard had killed her and three other victims. We were looking at it together. She was lying there on some pavement, with another student kneeling down looking at her, as I remember. These people were our audience. That's exactly who we were playing for. It was our movement, our culture, our Woodstock generation. We were all one. It was a personal thing, the bond we held between the musicians and the people of the culture. Hippies, students, flower children, call them what you will. We were all together. The weight of that picture cut us to the quick. We had heard and seen the news on TV, but this picture was the first time we had to stop and reflect. I picked up my guitar and started to play some chords and immediately wrote Ohio, Four Dead in Ohio. The next day we went into the studio in LA and cut the song.
Casper, you raised an interesting point when you said that this wouldn't be read by anyone but fans. But who but fans would read these books? Surely that's who it's aimed at.
Well, you know, they've got big fan bases, these people, after being around for 40 years. I mean, the Dylan thing, I think, works properly as a piece of literature. And probably literature is the right word. I mean, it's very hard to say with the Dylan book how much of it's made up and how much is truthful, and that's true of his whole oeuvre. There's also people like, you know, proper pop stars of the modern era, like Will Young.
Who's written his own book, apparently?
Who I think has written his own book. I mean, it's slightly, having been really stuck in this world of Neil Young and Pete Townsend, and also Rod Stewart, and I'm not allowed to say that I've read the Rod Stewart book, so I won't say that it's an awful lot of fun and full of sort of ridiculous tales and doesn't really involve any navel gazing. It's just a succession of hilarious stories about his hilarious life. But having been stuck in that, which is very much sort of that rock aristocracy, to then read Will Young's book, which I confess I've only dipped into, but the first chapter is about his life at boarding school and this kind of long, endless anecdote about some incident in a diving competition once, and it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah. As well as the self-penned portraits, there are various biographies, aren't there? Mick Jagger is one of this Super Thursday's titles.
Yep, who is the recipient of a biography by Philip Norman, who, of course, has written about the Beatles at great length before. I've not had a chance to look at that either. It'd be interesting to see. One of the interesting things about the Townsend book is his description of the size of seeing Jagger's penis once, and he talks about it in quite flattering terms. And of course, Keith Richards' book was highly disparaging about Jagger in that respect.
Please, so, we're readers.
We'll see if the Philip Norman book sheds more light on that. And then there's also Barney Hopkins' book on Led Zeppelin, which is an oral history. There's a very thorough study of Prince published by Faber by the writer Matt Thorne. So there's a lot of the stuff around.
On that note, I think we're going to expel you from the books podcast. You're getting a bit sort of rock and roll on us, Casper. Thank you very much anyway for coming in.
Gotta be 21, it's gonna be a good year. Especially if you and me see it together. So you think 21 is gonna be a good year? Think of me and her, but you and her forever.
Well, that's all from us this week. If you'd like to discover what our reviewers think of the books, you can find our verdict on Mick Jagger in The Guardian's Saturday Review. In today's film and music, Alexis Petridis interviews Neil Young. And next Wednesday, you can read an interview with Pete Townsend. So from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
For a limited period only, we have an exclusive ebook offer for Guardian podcast listeners. Guardian columnist Luke Harding's Mafia State is a dark and ominous insight into the life of a journalist in present-day Russia. We're offering 30% off the list price of $4.99. All you have to do is go to the ebook store www.kobo.com, that's KOBO.com, and at checkout put in the discount code Mafia State for your Guardian podcast offer.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.